Okay, well, so maybe just a formal beginning for the recording if we're going to donate this to the archives. So today is, what is this? So it's March the 20th, 2018, and I'm David Brownstein here with Juanita Russell, possibly. We'll see, and Tom Brown, and we're here to have just an informal forest history, oral history interview. So I'm very happy to start out. Could you tell us a little bit about your parents and grandparents, where they might have come from, and anything that you think is interesting about them at all?
Well, how far back to start? And just my own family, maybe.
Sure, yeah.
My grandma, she was a re oh Reagan. She came from Ireland, and my grandpa, he was came to Canada years and years ago. Granddaughter traced back, and they've been there for years and years. So I'm not sure where he came from. Anyways, my family, they moved out here from the prairie in 1800. It's up in Willoughby there, and when I was that's where I was born. And when I was 3 years old, I moved over to 200 up on the foot of the hill, 264, just past where Home Depot is. And then at that time, that was called Carbald Road, and that's where it stopped there. And so he, the road right at the foot of the hill, it was trees and everything, and he helped open that up in there. And then he started the sawmill in there, and they cut lumber for quite a few years. And finally, they had trouble with the power on it, and so they went and found a steam engine down in the flats at Ladner that they were using for thrashing, and they with horses, because there's no power with it, they had to pull it with horses, or and it we ran the sawmill there. And where the heck? I guess I worked there. I didn't work because I was going to school. Then my uncle, he was in town. He had a wood business delivering wood, and he coal and stuff at that time, and he did quit and went out to work somewhere else anyway. So he left. My brother had been working for him, and so he said if Uncle Ernie is leaving, then we can have his business. So come on in, because I was still out here, and he said come in. And we had an old car there. He said get. Bring that in, and he was going to trade it in for a truck, which he did. So we went to delivering sawdust and coal for quite a while. And
And can I, so when might that have been?
that'd be, I was probably about 10, 12 years old, I guess, pretty young there. So I'm not sure. That's born 23, so that'd be about 45. Well, it wasn't too long before, because after that I left and there and went up to Hope working on the shingle mill up there for my dad. And that's when I got a call up for the army. At that time, they just called you up, and you could go in and register. And if you joined then, you could stay here. But I got my call up, and I went in, and I signed up, and then I signed for to go overseas. So that's when I left, and then I took my training down in Petawawa, and then Peterborough, Ontario. They shipped me from here down there, and that's the first time I'd been away from BC. Then I took my basic training in Peterborough, and then advanced training up in Petawawa, and then Turtle, Nova Scotia, and then they shipped me overseas. So I guess I'm getting into too much moon life instead of logging. So
okay.
I've got to get out of this logging.
Yeah. Well, so these are all interesting things. If we can just go back to your parents and grandparents for a second, just to help situate yourself. Could you tell us a bit more about your grandparents, whatever you know? And then once we've exhausted that, your parents?
Well, my grandpa and his wife, they worked for the train when the train was coming across Canada. And my grandma was a cook, and my grandpa, he was hunter. They used buffalo. That's where the buffalo meat went. So he shot the meat and worked there.
So that's when they were on the prairies.
Yes, on the prairies.
Yeah.
And then I guess the train was, I'm not yet sure what happened there, why, but I guess because that was quite a while ago when they were building the railroad across Canada. So then I guess when they finished the railroad, then they had to go back to farming, and then they did have a farm. But there were like a lot of people back at that time. There was an awful lot of people moving out here. And I don't know just how, there was quite a big family of them, four or five of them, and they all had land up on top of the hill up in Willoughby around there. And they all come out into one spot where I was born, and they walked, from Willoughby way over to up at 200 up top, and they all built houses for themselves there at that time. So I don't know where they got money or anything, because I was too young to remember that. So that, although my dad did when he come out, I remember that he stayed in town. I think somehow my grandpa moved in. Anyway, they lived in town and they collected shells from the ocean, and I think the grandmother, I think maybe you could just sell some, but they use them for the chickens. That's where they got the chicken. And they would collect shells, I remember him saying that. And he married her.
Yeah.
And she was...
So these are your parents now that you're describing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when they lived on the prairie, they... The Browns, let's see, how the heck... My mom is from... she's an American. She was born in down the States in Kansas City, I guess it is. And they moved up here, and some place away from town, out in the country. And the Browns lived 2 or 3 miles out, and they bought a place another 2 or 3 miles further on. So my mom was met them at that time, and she got to stay with the Browns and go to school with them. So when they moved out here, she came with them, and they weren't still wasn't married or anything, but they got married when they got out here. So that's about all I know back with the family history back there.
Okay, so can you describe your parents' life? Lives at about the time when you would have been born? What sort of things would they have been doing?
When I was born, for quite a few years, they were pretty good times then. Because they had the sawmill there, but it wasn't too long in when the Depression hit. That's why it was the sawmill, and then it was tough times, but they got relief. Then they called it. You could go and get relief, but you get so much money a month, and if you're a family, you get so much, and then so much for each child. But whatever it was, the amount of money, you had to go up with pick and shovel and work on the road, digging ditches and gravel and stuff. And that's what they did with the Carwalls Road and stuff, built it up the hill, because 72nd went across the top, at 200 stopped at the bottom. And all of the roads around that, the people had to, you know, then it wasn't like today, they didn't give you the money and stuff. Uh-huh. They went, they're complaining because they got to go and pick it up. They, and if you were single, they shipped you out of town. Out in the whole Princeton Highway, out the 9 miles out there just before the slide, it's a big relief camp there, and that was one of the ones. You went out and stayed in the relief camp and worked for your money mm-hmm. back then.
So can I understand, so your father, in addition to having the mill, was also doing some of these other things?
No? That was later, because I guess... I don't really know what happened to the mill, but I guess back at that time, I guess it just, it could be they ran out of timber around there, or that part I don't really know why they, I can just remember there, I can remember the mill being there, I remember because the steam engine, I remember going down there, and they used to say here in Langley, because it wasn't far straight now, and you can see up where they were. We'd blow the whistle at, I think it was 8 o'clock or something for starting time, and they could hear it down here. Mm. But I can remember that, but I can't remember the transition from that to when there was no mill. And I must have been, well, because then I was older, you know, because I, you know, I was born there 3 years old, so when the mill, I guess it was only 6 or 7 or something, I was really young. Mm. And then... Anyways, I'm not sure.
I'm very aware that I'm prodding you with questions for things that were a long time ago, and you would have been very young, right? I'm aware of that, so that's okay.
Well, that's why I'm kind of confused with that. And that's the trouble with me. It seemed like I jump. I didn't stay a long time in one place.
Yeah, don't worry.
And why to try and figure out the dates of where it was. Don't
worry about it. I mean, so we can switch gears to focus just on you, right? It'll probably be easier to share some of those details.
Well, it's just about as tough for me, because I bounced around too so much that it seemed like I never stayed in the same place.
Okay.
And,
So we'll start. So you went to school around here?
Yes, at Langley.
Oh, okay. Great. And then, so continue on the story from there, however else you'd like to. So you worked with your family?
Yeah. Well, no. Before, when I was young, actually, I didn't work for the family, although in one way I did, because he had horses and... So I, on the weekends, I'd take a horse and a plow, and I'd go out and plow gardens for people, and I could make pretty good money.
Okay. How much money? What was pretty good money, do you think?
Oh, they'd give me 50 cents or a dollar, you know, if I plowed the garden for them.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that's
great.
Pretty big money for back then.
Yeah.
And I could go to, on the weekend, you know, some two or three places, sometimes 4 a day. So, you know, for back in those days, that was pretty big money.
Right.
For the family, and that helped, you know, them. And also it was good for me, because we had a bunch of kids there, and my family, I had an older brother. And back in those days, particularly our place there, it was kind of a home for everybody around there. It all come, and we had that big square dances every 1 month, sometimes closer than that, and people would walk for a long ways and come and square dance all night, and people would play, and they bring their family with it, and we had a big house there, and the kids would go upstairs in the bed, and they'd put the girls one way and the boys the other way. And Alan, who was just here, he talks about that, because my wife, she lived up top of the hill up there, and I went to school with her, and she's Well, I met them as soon as they moved up Prairie when, I was seven and she 2 years younger. She was seven when they moved out here. And they walked to school, so we went to school together. And mm-hmm. They had the four girls in her family, and there was four girls in ours, four boys. There was eight in our family. And when they walk home, some of their girls would always come to our place, and some would go up to theirs. And so that's why I got to going with her. It seemed like we'd always chum together all the time.
Okay. So what was her name?
June.
Okay, and her maiden name?
Skelton.
Skelton. Skelton. All right. So at these parties, these square dances, were you a musician or you were just a dancer?
I couldn't even dance good.
Oh, I'm sure just, you. I well, obviously listened. You danced well enough for her.
Well, it seemed like we just seemed to go together. And there was another friend of mine, he was a little older than I was, and he had a car, and he went by wife's older sister. So again, I made enough money, so I had money to buy gas, and we'd go come to shows and things like that. And it was a coupe, so we'd have to sit all four in there, but she'd sit my knee and we'd go to shows. So that we did that right up until the war broke out. And when the war broke out, right away, then everybody started getting jobs, and particularly the women and stuff. They got jobs at the shipyards. Not a lot of them. They the rivet, because they rivet the ships together, and they throw them up, and the wind, you know, as the net would catch them and pass. And the other jobs, there was a lot of women work in the shipyards, and the men, the ones that stayed home, they got jobs there. So right away, then instead of coming to the party and stuff there, they'd go to the beer parlor first and hang around and. Oh. And get money, and they wouldn't come. And when they come, and then it was getting rowdy, and it just killed the parties.
Okay.
Money come in.
So in about the same time that you went to Ontario for your military training, so June was working in a shipyard here somewhere.
No, she was too young for the shipyard because. No, she was still going to school. She took training in school to in Westminster. She went to training there, and she used to go in on the, I think it was a bus, and on the weekends she'd come home, and then there was a milk truck that she got to know them, and they bring her out. And it's funny that. There was a fellow that lived right in between. They lived, like I say, up in 72nd and down a little bit. And there was some other people that moved in, Jack Jones, McConnell's, their name was. And was when, I guess that was when I was away in the Army, that she was taking that training. And she'd come out on the Fraser Highway at 72nd up, but top of the hill there, and then was they dump her off there. And Jack, he worked down close to there at the farm, and he got to know that. So he'd go down and meet her there, and give her a ride on the bicycle up to their place, on the crossbar, ride her home. So,
what year did you get married, Tom?
Right after the war, when I come back from. See, that seemed to be the thing to do. I didn't think much about marriage. Mind you, like I say, we chummed around steady, and when I went in the Army, and she wrote to me all the time when I was overseas and everything, and it just seemed like everybody, when they come back from overseas, everybody seemed to get married, so why not?
Did you write back?
A little bit, not too much. I never was much of a writer.
Okay, that's fine.
we couldn't say anything. Our letters said, boy, it was real strict. You didn't say anything where you were or anything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They didn't want you in letters, so.
Okay. Before going on to other things, is there anything else that you want to say about the war, or is that enough of that?
Well, I don't know. They tipped me over to overseas about 6 or 8 months, I guess, before the invasion. So I was stationed in England for waiting for the invasion, and we weren't too far from London, and then absolutely blackout. You could go downtown London, there was not a crack of light anywhere. And the same way with the trains, it would travel, it had trains in there, it was so fast. And boy, when you come to a station, that thing had just stopped up, and both doors would open, and out you'd go. And people there, they all knew it, and they could do. But if you were going someplace, boy, you'd have to try and figure out where. Otherwise, it'd beep, beep, and you'd be gone.
Right.
So it was. So anyways, then went in on the invasion, and I was in France and Belgium and Holland, and I was up in Germany when the war ended. And so then when the war ended, I stayed for a while there picking up the equipment. And the war ended, everybody just jumped out of their equipment and left everything just sitting. And there's a great big field where they brought all the vehicles in. So I helped, because I was a mechanic and driver, so that, you know, what they wanted is somebody. And they were having trouble, because very few people wanted to do that. They wanted to get out of there and get going. So, but I did that for a couple of months, I guess. I forget how long I did. And then I did go back to England, and then I had to wait there for a ship to come home. So I went down, and as a fellow, they were tearing down the bombed out buildings, with a lot of those, because they were brick buildings at the top, and a lot of buildings were damaged, and they were tearing them down. So I got talking to the son of the owner, and they were having trouble getting mechanics with stuff, and I said, helped him out getting some going, and he said, you know, how much he'd like to have somebody. So I said, well, talk to the officer in the camp. I said, I've heard that they give permission that we could come and work for somebody until it's there. So he did. So I worked for them for maybe 6 months there. And I had a good job just going around starting equipment and doing things. So, but anyways, I came home, and that's when right away, the war affected me a little bit, and I knew I had to keep busy. That was a big thing. That's why there, as long as I could keep busy, no problem. But if I stopped and sat down, I right away started getting in trouble. So I did that. I was lucky. There was a friend of my dad's. He had a garage down in Fort Langley, and he'd been in the Air Force too, and he didn't own the garage, but he was contracting them out from the fellow that owned it, and he said that he had lots of work coming down. Come on down, work for me for a while. So I did, went right away down and worked with him. And then this same fellow that took my oldest wife's sister out with him, he could arrive back home too. And so we decided we'd get together and start the sawmill. And we started the sawmill up there and sawed lumber for quite a while until we kind of ran out of timber here, and for some reason I got in touch with somebody out in Zaterna Island, and went out and looked, and they decided that we decided that it'd be a good place, so we packed up and moved out to Zaterna.
So what, can I ask, when might that have been, do you think?
I'd probably be in 47, maybe, because that'd be probably a year, maybe 2 years here, and then we moved out there, because 52 we went out. But out there, we cut lumber and worked for a whole year cutting lumber. And then we got a scow in and loaded. We had to load it by hand, and I think we had about 1 million board feet of timber, big barge. I got some film I should show you later of the barge and loading it, loaded it all up, and got it. But there was a friend of ours, he had that small tugboat, and he wanted work, so like a fool, I told him, give him a job to tow it across. And I guess he got up a storm come up, and the wind was pretty big, and I guess he couldn't make it. And anyways, the wind got strong enough, it tipped the scow over and dumped it all in the salt chuck.
What happened to him?
No, it didn't hurt. It didn't hit.
And everything was...
They thought for a minute, because Alan and one, two brothers, Alan and the younger brother, was with him. Because we knew him, and he stayed at our place and everything. And so they were with him. And he was he told them to, if the scow decided to sink or anything, he was there with an axe. And that was his job, to chop the rope if it did. But it didn't. It survived okay. So then I decided I didn't like that. And the Pohl brothers, people that I got into logging with later, and Bruce and stuff for that company, they had just moved to Zaterna. And when they come in with a scow with equipment, they got in a bunch of trouble there, and they didn't know anything about mechanic work or that. And so I just jumped in and helped them, and this while I was still logging. But once that scow tipped over, because at that time we hadn't got any money yet, because we were cutting the lumber expecting to get it. So boy, I was in pretty desperate shape. So I talked to them, and they said, right away, come to work for us. So that's when I first got a first job. And boy, it was good, because I got paid money coming in there. So I worked for them for about a year or so. And they ran out of timber there. And
so this is all still on Zaterna?
Yeah, that's on Zaterna. Okay. Ed was lucky, because the dump was right where our beside our house and everything, so it worked out just perfect for me. And so I worked there until they ran out of timber, and they got some more timber. At that time, you could put timber up for sale pretty well anywhere, and then when you got it, you had to go out and you had to move your camp in, and everything. There was nothing there, just bush. You had to do everything. And they were going up Theodosia Arm, and there was no school or anything there. So I said, what do you, because we had our daughter axed by then, our daughter was born, and I don't know if I want to go up there to a place like that. So I didn't, I stayed on Zaterna, and they moved up there. And so there was no work or anything in Zaterna. So there was a store there, and the government wharf, they had a marina there. So I decided, the old fellow that had it, he wanted to get out of it anyways. I had known him, Jackson, and so I made a deal and bought the store and the government wharf. But I made a big mistake on that. People there on the island there, they down that they're buying up this store there, and they're whining and crying because the bread was a little stale, or that was this, and they wouldn't pay, charge it up, and oh man, it. So I did too long, and lucky, because about a year, I was, wasn't for too much timber up in Theodore's Arm, and they moved up to Crab Apple Creek, where we are over there. And Ernie, the one in particular, he was after me because there, this timber, they never looked at the timber or anything. They just went, M&B owned this timber, and they'd had it for years, and nobody would take it. They couldn't get anybody to log it because it was a mile back, straight back they logged, and it was, I think, 3,000 feet up on there, and that it was narrow place. And like I say, the poor brothers, they took it and pulled the cat up there, and he was down there steady begging me to come make it. And finally I said, well, okay, maybe I'll go. So again, I had to, my wife, I had to say to her, pack up, we're going up to Jervis. So I was going to go up and look, but I said, oh, the heck, I need the money, I'm just going to go. And we did, we packed up. And boy, in the morning, the same way as my wife, that's what she's saying, because at that time you got on the boat in Vancouver at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it was midnight time. It was, I think, over 20 logging camps at that time, here at the Express. And they dumped us off with her. They just had a float tied out there from the boat, and it was anchored out away from shore a long way, so you had to paddle in. And we got in the middle of the night with Sherry and the cat and the dog and the wharf, and the boys were waiting there. So she said, well, where's the bunk out in there? Ernie, I guess, was said, well, they're up there. There was another fellow there. He'll take you in, get in the rowboat. So they got in a little rowboat and rowed in, and got a dark cheek. So he said, okay, this is it, get out. So she got out, and she's up her knees in water. And it was dull, dark, there's no lights or anything. She got up, and that's her house over there, he said. And it was sitting on that much of an angle. She couldn't get in, and no lights. And boy, that's what she said, because the boat had went up to, they had the inlet, which is only another half hour's drive in the boat, and stayed there overnight, and then come back in the morning. And we could do that if you wanted to stop. And you would leave, put a flag up, and they'd stop on the way back to town. She said, "If I'd have known that, I'd have been on that boat and gone out of here."
Yeah.
But okay. And I said, "Well, I probably would have been with you, because same way as me in the morning when I got up and looked around, I said to the boys, I said, well, what's happening now? Well, there's where the timber is up there." And again, and that's what they were saying. Come on, let's get going and get building road. And I said, look, we got no cabin. So we had to start, and then we had to figure out how to get the road up there. They had decided they were going to just take a cat and arch. That's what we were doing before, dragging logs. But with this, it was so steep and far, and that's when I said, well, number one, we've got to figure out how to get up there, because you know that it's so steep, and there's going to be switchbacks and everything. And so we've got an awful lot of work to do, and which it was, we had to go then and start at the top, and that's the trouble. When you come down, you get the grade, but you've got to get to a place on the side of the where you can make a switchback to come back and forth. So it took us a lot of time. But by then, it was pretty near 3 miles of road, and so that was way too far for steel tracks. So again, I was lucky. I went, and that's when I got the turner skidder up there, that one, uh-huh. And used it and saved it. And then that's the same arch we'd used on Saturnus that was steel tracks on it, and took the steel tracks off and big rubber tired, and lucky I found that down at Eugene at a big, they used to have a big convention every year, and that somebody was there with that turning skidder. And no, they weren't there. Anyways, I found out from there that so I got in touch with them and with Letourneau, and they decided they would build it for logging, and that's when we got the first one that, up in Canada here. And but it worked. It did a good job at that thing.
Was that at the Oregon Logging Conference?
We used to go to every year. Mm-hmm. And Bruce, that was quite a complicated little bit, because it was skid steer, so you drop the air on one side and step on the brakes on the steer, and it was a button. So it was a skid steer effect, and it took a little bit of training to to handle it coming down the hill.
Hmm. And so was there anybody helping you? I mean, in learning all of these skills, how to run things properly, at least more efficiently, or you're pretty much self-taught in all of these things.
Not the same with all the stuff, and that's what was so good with Bruce. You didn't have to do that; you just get on it and do it. And although it's true, that's the way. I don't know that Bruce and I it was me. There was nobody else that I would on that transporter would have let them run it. Because it was a little more. The transporter was worse than that was, because with the transporter it was all electric on it, and with electricity on there with the electric motor in each wheel, and I think it was 60-1, I think. So that motor was turning 60 times as fast. So if you went a mile an hour faster, that motor was, and once you get, when the motor loses sync in between, they'll fade out, right? They just pretty well drop off to become freewheeling. So you have to be very, very careful and keep it. As long as if you got control there, you're good. But if you lose that, so there was a disc brake on the top of each motor, and you could use the switch there and just flick. If you snapped them on, you had to be careful with a big load, because they were so powerful that because they would have stopped the machine. But if you had a big load of logs on there, it was running away anyways. There was too much there, and it would either it would never sheared any, but it would just those plates, because then they were so powerful and there's so much power on them, they just heat up and so we had to be pretty. And on top of that, and the switchback coming down the hill, you had to, it was CPR style. You had to drive in, and one place you had to back down with it, and stuff. So it was until it was flat. That's the only place that, or Bruce and I wouldn't let anybody else drive it down there. That was Bruce and myself. It was no danger, because I don't know. I didn't think there was any runaway or anything.
Right. So how long were you and June there at that particular float camp? After your initial introduction to the place.
Well, we. How long were we? What happened is that on this valley of timber up there, it was in a bowl, and we didn't have enough sense. Up till that time, if you ran out of timber, you'd just go and buy something else. You could put up a stand of timber and get more. So when we realized that it was just a bowl, and once that was finished, there was nothing there. So we had to start looking around for more timber. Mm-hmm. And we looked, and up at the head of the of the Jervis. That's the place where they should have went first, but they didn't know that. And they didn't probably have the money. So I stepped back. See, that was the big thing back then. And with M&B, they wanted that timber so bad that they just said, you log it for us and get, of course, they had first refusal on the timber. And if we wanted equipment, same way as that, we just phone them and they give us the cash for it. And well, same with that transporter there. I think it was, $70,000 or something it was back then. It was quite a bit of money. But they just give us a check for it. But they wanted our timber. And, you know, they got the timber. So, when we built the head, that was bigger. And that was a valley that went for miles. That was in nice timber and everything. And we had cruised it and put it up for, yeah, I think we put it up for sale. We're just, anyway, just about that time when we did it, they come up with that, I needed to start checking and figured there wasn't enough timber. We're overcutting. So they went through and figured out some kind of a mathematical thing, I guess, to give you a quota on how much logs you can have. And with us, because the pole barn had moved around so much, and we worked on it almost 2 years, I guess, on the start there, and we didn't do any logging. We're building this road up there, and the pole barn, because they stopped and moved, so when you went back their history, they didn't have any, so we got a very small quota. And then this block of timber we put up there, it was a big block, and they told you that, you know, in order to put that up, you had to log so much a month or a year out of there. Well, we didn't have the quota. Now we had the thing all set up there, and we didn't have enough quota to put it up for sale. So we were short of quota. And then also, being it was a big valley that, you know, we could have stayed for years. And at that time, things had changed. So we had all old equipment, wooden spar trees and old stuff. And by then, things had changed up to mobile equipment, and the same way with our camp, because it would have been a bigger camp, so we needed. So our camp was all outdated, and we didn't have enough quota. So, but anyways, we were still thinking we could do it. So we, luckily across the way, there was another camp. And the mill owned it, and their son ran it, and he committed suicide. And so we talked to the mill, and they said they'd give us their quota if we'd finish it up. And they were the same. They were looking for timber, of course. So they said they would give us a quota if we'd finish theirs. But still with theirs, would give us quite a bit, but still not enough. So there's another camp up the inlet from us, and he went broke. So I talked to the people there, and they said we could get that if we cleaned that out. So it gave us pretty well enough quota. We wouldn't were too bad off. But the thing is, now we had, you know, our own camp. We were just cleaning up with it, and the other camps, you know, just clearing up on that. It was tough trying to run. And that lucky Bruce, that's where the first camp, one of the camps, they got there. I got him to run over, then to take over and run it on the camp. Oh, Mokti said, I can't do that again. So I had quite a job talking to him to take over the camp and control his temper, because he, I don't know, maybe you noticed, he has had a little bit of a temper back in those days. So anyways, then we got talking to M&B and about this, because now we had to, you know, build a road and the new camp, new equipment, and the head, Jervis, is quite flat, so we'd have to build on the rock to get deep water from dumping. And there was a main, pretty big bridge we had to build, and the camp, and I don't know, I kind of roughly figured out, you know, the take of $1.5 million or something, even to get started, you know. So I was talking to M&B, and they said, well, what do you got to put up for quota or put up for security? Or before it was none of that, but mm-hmm. now they wanted security.
Mm-hmm. So why hit? Oh, sorry, please.
What year would that have been, roughly?
What year would that be? At about when Don or Whitmacomb get killed, remember? What year is that?
That was 71.
Yeah, so it'd be in the 70s, somewhere in the 70s, I guess.
71. Yeah,
yeah, probably be in the 70s, yeah.
So you were up there for a long time.
Yeah, quite a while. Yeah, I think for 18, 20 years up, mm-hmm. up there was. Yeah. Yeah, it was quite a while.
Was that, were you at Chatham Channel too?
No, that was later.
Oh, okay.
Bruce left, well, about when I did, or sold out to, well, to Bob Malpass here, was one of the ones that bought one of the camps. But I decided to get out of logging then. Yeah, that's something else maybe I think. I jumped there a little bit on the time. Are you in a hurry?
No. No hurry.
No. On Crabapple Creek, logged the valley out, there was more timber. So we logged the valley out, but there was timber up way higher up. So when we reached out as far as we could go, which is about 1,500 feet or so, and then there was more timber. So we moved a yarder up the side hill and rigged it back far up, higher up, and you could log another 1,200 feet in. And put a skyline 2,000 feet up, and yard the timber over to the top spar tree, and then hook on and send it down to the skyline down to the valley. And we logged that up, but then there was timber yet behind that. So that's when we decided that we'd have to put a road up there. Mm. So we had to build a road up, and then it was too far to drag the timber because all the way down, so we had to buy the transporter. So in between, while we're doing that, we built a tent camp up there, and the men would stay up there. They would actually, they'd run, and it was the first time for a while they rode again on the thing there. Before we built the camp, that's right. So they would, on the skyline, they put just a small log balance on the choker. And, well, I got pictures of them. There's four, two on each side, and they'd hang on to the cable and ride them up. And I guess that was the first year. And then, anyways, it doesn't matter, I guess, the sequence of it, because we decided that it was too slow or something, and we had a tent camp, and we had a woman. She'd go up there and stay all, but she wouldn't ride on. I tried to get her to, and so I made a box, set a box there. I think that much more set engines in. It was about 6 or 8 feet long before the big box, and that would send the groceries and stuff up there, and the men would ride up when the camp, and they'd go up and stay for the week up there, and they'd come down one day to the main camp. So, but that's the reason we had to get the, and that was a tough road to build because, again, back in that time, all these roads, when we built them, we always had to take the cat up and build them down because they're too steep. There was no way you could build in that kind of country. So it was always a pretty big job because you had to, you know, take the cat up right to the top.
So how did you get it up there to begin with?
Well, pretty well always it would take a yarder. You could get a yarder up through and then bring the cable down and hook onto it because it was straight up and it could go up. And then start. And some place wasn't bad, but this was particularly bad because it was so steep on there. So we had to go up there by hand and build enough roads so when I got up there, you could start working on it. But so it was lucky there because we did have a yarder beyond it. It was a spar tree, so it was good for when it went up, because we had a line down hooked on it, and the yarder, could hold you there, so no problem. And the same way then when I started working, because you have to be awful careful when you have a road like that. And, it's not solid enough, and with the can, if when you're pushing it, be off, But it was lucky there because I had a cable from the spar, but it was up just above and 100 feet high, and had a cable on the side of the can, so in case it did that. So
how many men would stay up in this tent camp?
Huh?
How many men would stay up in the tent camp?
I think there was about 5 or 6, and Lady Cook.
And they'd stay up there for how many days?
5 days, or 6 days. 6 days, because one day off, 6 days, I think. 6 days, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And all sorts of weather.
Well, in summer, good weather.
Yeah.
We didn't work in the winter. We closed down in the winter, so. Oh. So, yeah.
So like May to October or something?
No, yeah, summer, yeah. I think we'd go out, depended on the weather again, too, when we'd open up. Yeah. But they didn't mind it. They liked that better than riding on the, and walking, because quite a few of them wouldn't ride up on it, the skyline. They didn't like that. They just,
cause we'd have been did you walk, like that?
Huh?
Did you like that?
Oh, I didn't mind walking that. My goodness, they had safe enough there. That packed tons of logs down.
Yeah.
When I was on it by myself, I didn't think I would. It was a big rock because the cable was big and heavy enough now, and the spar tree is 125 feet high, and the yard is sitting back out here. So when your logs come in, they're just a piece of cable from down where from there to the yard there's twice as much. So when you're on what you couldn't unhook because the weight of that would keep the choker so tight you couldn't even on. So we drill a big rock, about 4 foot rock, and hang it on the butt rigging, and then it'd pull pull slack for you so you know. So that's what they were saying. I got pictures. I have pictures of it, and I hope it's not in the other one. I can look later. Of those guys getting into sitting there on the big rock and on top. So that I wouldn't like to ride that too much, and I never did ride it with 4 people on it because if one guy would panic out there and you get off balance, you'd be in trouble. I didn't really, that wasn't my favorite. But in the morning, I used to, I'd go up in, first thing in the morning because with the back, mind you, had whistles there, but at first thing in the morning, there's nobody up there. So you'd have to ride in from the bottom. It was awful hard to see exactly, and the way the tree was up high, and when you come up, there was a bluff here that when the cable was pretty close to that, the logs would just go over it and down. So you could see that pretty well from the yarder, and he was good. So in the morning, if there's nobody up there blowing whistles, I'd go up first thing and blow, and when you went by there, you could drop off. Otherwise, he'd try and stop, but it's hard to tell whether. And as soon as you went by this, so long, then it would start going up to the tree. And if he slackened it down too much, then you had to drop off, and it was so steep there, because then he'd drag you over it. So it was a little complicated there to keep keep it just right.
To say the least.
So that you, you know, you could either jump. Well, you didn't have to worry too much because you could, you know, jump off. Or, so, and sometimes if you didn't, then if you took it far enough, then he could see a up by the tree. And then, but then again, it slacked off. And so that was a little bit of a nuisance, that part. And, but it worked out all right.
Okay, wondering to change gears a little bit. So we've mentioned quite a few times Bruce Russell in this conversation, but he's never been formally introduced. So could you tell us a little bit about how your paths may have crossed and how, you know, things unfolded after that?
How did I... I think, I think another fellow, a friend of mine, liked that machine, and he bought one, and Bruce worked for him, and the company that we bought it from, they would have a kind of a schooling every in the winter time, and they sent us right down to the factory at Peoria.
Is that a picture of it there behind you?
Of that with that's it. No, that's from quite about that's further than that's quite a bit later. After that we bought that was the first one, and it was mechanical, and that's the first electric one, so that come later, after even this we needed that, so that was what the
boy, that's station. A monster.
But anyways, Bruce come down, and I met him there, and we got along, and they talked, and I just liked him, the way he seemed so interested and everything. So I asked him, and I think at that time I had to bug him for a while to get him to come, but he finally he did. And right away, you know, he was just—I could see with him, boy, he was just so eager. He was at night out there, just he, you know, the rest of the people, they wouldn't. If you asked them to come out, they'd want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But Bruce, he'd no matter what, out at night, he'd be out there with me and asking, "Can he do this? And can he do that?" And you know, just—he was just so good. He just. And actually, that machine, when we bought it, he was driving it. I don't know if it shows there on that thing or not. Yeah, oh yeah, here on this, he right in here, because they would pull it, they would come around the corner, and it did bend that right over the side like that. And that, see, going around the switchback, you pull so hard on that it would pull the weight right up to all the weight of the whole machine would be on that one axle there. So there's tremendous power there, and it just wasn't raised enough, and it buckled that right over. And boy, Bruce was out, well, it was me, and we stayed up all night welding, and we had it going for the morning. And that was with us pretty well all the times. They were in sequence. We were in Big Valley, where we had a bunch of things and they could log with us. It was a chain of things, and if something broke down like that, you were closed down. Mm-hmm. You couldn't, because there wasn't room to pile anything up. So we stayed. And what's funny too, because in the morning, I said to Bruce, I said, I'll go and you go and have a rest, and I'll make the first trip, and you have a rest, and because he was driving it, and you drive the rest of the day. So. I went up the hill, and boy, and to get daylight, man, time I got back, I could hardly see, and so I went and run over to Bruce, and I said, "Come, Bruce, come, take this thing. I gotta go to bed." And Bruce got up, and he was worse than me. Man, both of us, our eyes. But Bruce said, "Oh, I can do it." I said, "Well, no, what they said this." Forget it, go back to bed. And no, and he was, again, he went.
June must have been working pretty hard. Did you have the two children by then?
Yes, yeah. You know, she handled things. She could get along so good in camp. And, and you know, just, not like Bruce, he was just the same as another one of the family with us. He was in the house and with the kids and stuff. And, you know, he'd grab Larry and stand him up and he'd walk across the ceiling. So, yeah, he and Bruce was great. But that pretty much, then I went from there to on the Gold River Highway out of, from Campbell River to Gold River. And I bought five Latrina scrapers and well, in the meantime, Bruce had left. When he got that contract from Don Lilly, there, and when Jim, his brother, got killed in, I guess Don was in that plane too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And his wife took over the company there, and so they got a contract, and that's when Bruce went on his own, and that's when I sold out and went on, took the on the Gold River Highway. And that was a pretty good contract, but it was supposed to be for 5 years, and it only lasted about a year and a half, and they went broke. So I was lucky that the turner scrapers I had, they were turner poles, and on the front end, well, actually it was the same. No, I haven't got a turner pole there, but the front end, you could take take the arch off and put scrapers on them, and with them they were electric steering, and the motor, the whole front end hinged right around, so real short, and on the highway, they with the shovel, when they loaded the trucks and hauled it down, they dumped the rocks just into the lake. But with the trucks, they had to dump the load right in the middle and then come out of the way, and the cat would come and push the load over the bank. But with the scrapers, we could come down and stop, and you could turn that in the road, because it hadn't turned right around the motor and shortened it up, and you could just turn around and back right to the edge. And you back up close to the edge, because once your wheels were out in good solid ground on the middle of the road, so it didn't matter if the ground did cave down a little bit, you could just let the load drive away, pull it up. But with the trucks, of course, if it went down that way, the whole truck would go. Mm-hmm. So we could just come down and turn around. So that's why they gave me the contract with it like that. So I took that turner skater and pulled a grid roller out and steady up and down the road on that, and I had a grader, so I had quite a bit of quite a good contract in about a year. And then I had the contract and all the equipment. But I got a job up in Penticton building a dam up there, and again, that was the same with Eric. I got away from something what I knew what I was doing, and something that I didn't know. And I worked there about a year, and the contractor went broke there. So, and again, McPhail took over, and I thought I'd get with him, but no, he didn't. He said, I didn't buy that for give you a job. I bought it for my own equipment. So I got.
So
but lucky I could.
I was just going to ask, the Gold River Road, who did you get the contract from?
The government.
It was the government.
Yeah, the government. Yeah, the government
through the Gold River.
Yeah, the government contract, yeah. And that's why, I guess, they chopped it, because they were supposed to go right through to Port Hardy there. So, would have been a good job, though, because I'd make good money there on that. And it was easy because it's a flat road. For me, that was something there.
And so where did you live? in that period?
Well, in 52, we bought the house in Wally.
Oh.
And of course, June lived there steady.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. No more.
No, I was after the Penticton at the mine. Ed was lucky because by then, Vancouver Equipment that had bought most of this equipment from, they had the electric trucks, haul pack trucks were just coming out. So Red Briscoe, and he's the fellow that came up, and he was supposed to come out up and demonstrate that, because he was a demonstrator. But for some reason, he was away, and they didn't. They just sent their mechanic up there, and when he looked at it, he said, "No way, I'm not going to drive that on the on that hill." But anyways, it didn't matter. Red, he by this was then what, 10-15 years, I guess, later, when all this happened, and I sold out there. He was, I think, the assistant manager of the company by then. And that's right away, he said, "Holy smoke, come to work for us. We're getting these electric trucks going in there." And he said, "I want you to go up with that." So that Red was about 6 months or a year. And I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" And well, they were just getting skidders out at that day, so he said, "You can go and demo new skidders until it worked." And so I did that. Boy, I thought that was really something, because I got a paycheck coming in there every day and didn't have to worry all those years there before. You know, not only the equipment, but you know, I had men every month. You'd have to worry about, you know, if you had 8 or 10 men there every. So I did. Gee, no worrying. All I do is just collect that money. And the same way with June, my wife, "Holy smokes," she said, "this is great." She said, because that was the trouble before in logging, you know, when we're up and down, and it was always the same with her. And, you know, she was so good, because that's what I told her, that she's, you know, not to charge anything. I don't want any credit. I don't want to have any bills, because I never know when I've got money and when I haven't. And I think it was good, because she saved up and I was lucky, because with our property, when I bought it, the company was making pretty good, and so I could go through the company, but you know, and then just pay it off to them, so I didn't have to pay finances or anything on it, so it was good. But with her, even then, you know, said to her, you know, "Don't get carried away." And she was good. She didn't like that. She brought stuff and powder boxes down and put the MacTac and cushions on them and went down to Ayers here in Langley and bought some used table and chairs and stuff. And so she was good. She just didn't mind.
Well, that was
she probably didn't like it, but.
Oh.
That was a nice piece of property too that you bought there.
Yes, I was lucky there, because I again with the BLA, he was building houses there, and the one new house he built it for himself, and he wanted to sell the old one. But I went down and looked at it, and I didn't. It was an older house, and it was up in wood stilts and the basement. It was too old. No, I don't like that. I got talking to him about this stuff, and he said, "Well, I built this new house myself." And I said, "Well, you know, that's that for sale."
Who was that, Tom?
What was his name? I'll think of it in a minute if I could think about it. And anyways, he said something about, well, it's quite a bit of money for that house. So I asked him what it was. And I think it was $12,000. I think it was $12,000, I think it was, for it. And it was a three-bedroom home and full basement and hardwood, the regular hardwood, old hardwood floors. And, you know, it was a nice house. So I said, well, he says, if you'd sell it, I'll give you cash for it. Oh, cash, he said. So, so he did. He, and, but then I looked when I went up there, and I said, well, you know, I want a little bit of property here. And so I said, maybe we have to throw in another lot there. And, well, he didn't like that because he's going to build it. And, but I talked to him, and he owned the back too. So, but finally he said, okay, you can have it. So I got the lot. I paid $1,000 for it. And then, lucky for some reason, the next lot there was some old people. No, how the heck was it then? I just forget how it come up now, but it did. I guess they bought it. That's right. And they moved in, and so I right away told them, I said, "Some, if anything you guys decide to move or something, I want to buy it." And I think he passed away, and the wife went in the home, and so I got that. That was the third lot. And then one day he come up, because the back was a big lot, went the full length of the three of them. And he come up and he said, "Oh, you get lots of money?" And I said, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "A lot back here." He said, "If you want to buy that," because I was after him all the time. I said, "Anytime you think of that lot, don't be doing anything unless me." So he decided. So I went then for the army, and you could do that. You could get a pretty big brand, and they'd buy. But you had to have that, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to get this, and that gave me over. I think it was an acre they wanted, and that gave me that. So I got my wife's brother to take that. When I sold him, I didn't. There was no money exchange, but I sold him the lots that I had. I guess in his name. So anyways, I just forget how I did, but I put them all in one name, and then I went to BLA and said, "Here's this acre and a half for sale that I can buy." And so they come up and looked, and it was enough property, and they didn't say anything, and because then I bought it back off of him then. So that gave me that, and it was a pretty big one. The payments were so low on it that you paid, and then if you kept that up for 10 years or something, you got the grant off. So I got, I was pretty lucky. That one thing I got out of the war was pretty good. So, yeah, that property and all my bouncing around, that probably I've made more there than a low. Actually, on Saturna, we had the Poole brothers there. They bought some timber from a lady. I think it was a quarter section of property on Saturna, and we logged it off. And they just stayed in the company. And later we decided that we were going to do something with it, and we split it up. A partner and I, and he took half, and I took half of it, and it was a quarter section. And I don't know if Bruce ever told you, but him and Ellen, was after them, because they were a little bit bad. They work all summer up there, come to town, and they'd spend the whole thing. They'd spend it. I said to them, "Why don't you buy? That's a turn of profit off me, and you'll have something there. Put your money into that. Oh, you just want to get that, get rid of that. You don't want to." I don't know if did Bruce ever say
that? Yes, he said how foolish he was. He should have done it.
Yeah, or they owe that afterwards. I didn't make as much, because later I thought it was great property. At the back end, you could go up and you could see right down the Active Pass, and you could see over to Blaine and see the boats come in and out. And I thought it was kind of landlocked, but I had talked to some people there around the back, so I could get a road up. And I thought, why if I made a road up there and some lots up there? Boy, the Americans and people, they had the view and stuff, so that'll be worth a lot of money. But they decide they're going to put that trail, and it goes all the way up the coast. It's a I don't know what kind of trail thing.
The West Coast Trail?
Yeah, it's on, out in the West Coast.
Yeah.
It's, and our that property has got the only river, it's only a creek on it, and it's right in the middle, and it's really nice because that puts you the bottom part. The second row of trees growing up, and rocks down, moss, it's just a lovely, and they're going to build a, they want it, and they aren't, government, they went and bought property all around. Up till that time, I was kind of working on it. I was getting permission that I could come up through some other property at the back to get past the mine. But all of a sudden, they contacted me and they wanted to buy it. Mm. So I got checking and found out, you know, there was no way I could build a darn road up there anymore now. So, you know. But they bought it. They paid me some, but you know, not, I didn't make the big sweepstake that I thought I was going to make. So they probably might have, but mind you, I think if they'd have taken it, they probably would have sold it earlier. I might, you know, if I'd have thought, knowing that that was coming, then I could have probably got more money. But I got my name on the tag over there that they told me. I have never looked, but.
Is that when the Garners were logging over that way too?
Yeah, Garners. Yeah. They were on Allen. Yeah, there was quite a bit of logging on Saturna there mm-hmm. one time. So,
we kind of gotten. So you had been working on the highway on the island. River, you were also working more in the interior on a dam or in support of a dam.
Yeah,
in
a dam. Yeah.
So
irrigation dam.
Ah, okay, irrigation dam. So let's continue along your story after that. Anything else worth sharing?
Well, after I went with then in the mining business with the Hallmark trucks, and we did put the first trucks in at Lawrence Mine there. We shipped it, they come by rail up, and we started building the first one down in Cache Creek down, not Cache Creek, the one where you go down Cache Creek, not funny, I don't think of it a minute, when you're driving up the interior.
Boston Bar?
No, right up at
Ashcroft, I don't know.
Anyways, down the railway there, down there, and Ashcroft.
Ashcroft.
That's then we assembled one there, but we had trouble getting it up because it's so big. So we moved and we built the rest of them up at the mine, assembled them all, and so I stayed there for a while, and I guess. I was working for Vancouver Equipment, and GE, because they were some of the first trucks, and they had quite a lot of trouble with them, and I don't help them out, but I got doing quite a bit with them, and they decided they were wanted me to go work for them, because I didn't like that because I ship you all over. So they were putting trucks in at Fording Coal. So they talked to Vancouver Equipment, and that's what I told them, that I want to stay working. I'd like to do the work because I like that assembling. And they made a deal, so I went on loan to them and went out to Lawrence Mine. And also the electric shovels they had. Assembled out of those, and so I worked for them for quite a while, I guess. I don't know, a year or so. But finally, they had a big order way back east, and they knew I was assigned for that, so I got out of there. And how the heck did it? Oh, Vancouver Equipment, that's right, Vancouver Equipment. They were selling Washington logging equipment. And they, that's right, so I went back to work for them for a while, Washington Equipment. And then they decided, oh, Washington decided they would deal direct, get rid of the branches and deal direct. So I changed and worked for Washington, and with them, I had a good job. I was just traveling around. They were coming out with Interlock at that time. Interlock is for yarders. It's in the old days, with our yarder, we'd have a spar tree and cable would run up out of the woods, 1,000 feet or so. You'd hook onto a log then, and you had a haulback, of course, that would hold the drag the rigging out. But coming in, if you wanted to get lift so that on it, you'd have to step on the haulback and hold it back, and then it would lift the log up, the nose of the log up. If you just left it, you know, it'd drag and dig in on that. But the thing is that you'd have to step on the haulback to get the lift, and then you had to pull that friction off the log. So with haulback, or interlock, you reverse the cable so that when you haul the timber out, when it come back in, it's still under power, and it just powered off at the slow rate, and it kept the cable up without any brakes on it at all. So it was good. But with it, you had to, coming in, you had to change the ratio, because when it got out in the woods out there, it wound the drum, so the drum was right full. A haulback, the main was right empty because it was out as far as it could go. So when it started coming in, then the main would just pick up slow because there the haulback would, because it was full, would dump. So your lift would go away. It had to be like a clothesline. You had to keep them even. Mm-hmm. So that was the big job that we had. They had a lot of trouble, or we did, to find out how to get it so that. So I worked for quite a while with the engineer at Washington Iron, and I'd go down there. They sold a lot of yarders, so I'd go to the company and talk and work with them and with him, trying to figure out how to do that. So I worked there for quite a while, I guess. And also then with the equipment, I went out and they had their loaders and stuff. They had originally they loaded it with just shovels and stuff. They had converted them over, and with them they had levers. If you pull a lever, the boom would go up, and another big lever here pulled over to swing and push it there to do that, and it was a big manual thing. But Washington started, and they come out with a high speed loader, and with it they would put quad valves on it, and the quad valves up, and it's got four things. If you pull it this way, it'll do one thing, pull it that way, it'll do another, push it ahead, it'll do four things. And then they had on top of it, they had another two buttons, because there was, I think, going on this, they had about six. And so the people get used to that. Then for driving with it, you just, being it was hydraulic, and the valve there, you turn it over to driving, and you'd steer with that. You just steer back and forth like this. And the people, man, they couldn't get, they had trouble getting the steering with it. And so that was one of the things I had to find out, you know, do something about it, because people it was too dangerous. They just couldn't seem to adapt to it. So, different things when they're having problems with it, I'd go out and And so I that was nice, a good job. It was, I liked that.
So really what everything you've described there is you were involved in the development of all of this equipment.
Yeah. Oh, that was good. And the same way with the jack system for jacking, when you stopped, there you had big jacks, four of them, and they were in a tunnel, they were hinged on the tunnel. So there's a hydraulic ram, of course, would pull them back in. So when you were there, it ramage out, tip them out, and they had a big platform and a big cylinder on it, and then another valve, and it would, they had a ratchet and a dog, and they would lock in, of course, and then, so you'd raise the machine right up in the air. And they had trouble with that because of all the changeover of the valves. They had some dumb things there that had a sequence on it because the high and low, and you only had one tube down the middle and that swung, and there wasn't enough room there. It was so small that they had to, you know, use high and low air, and it was a real complicated system. And so that was my job to go out and figure out, you know, what to do about it. So I enjoyed things like that. And that's one thing, I guess, that I learned about troubleshooting and all the stuff I had is, you know, jobs like that, you want to be awful careful if you go out and try and fix them, and stop and think, you know, there's been a lot of people smarter than I am. They've been working and working here, and they can't figure it out, so I have to be careful to think that I'm going to jump in and do it. But, you know, if you pick brains and talk to people and like there, an awful lot of the things is I'd just decided to figure that out. I'll just do something else. And, you know, like the jacks there, I just got a hydraulic steering unit and put it on there, and put a steering wheel with a spline on it so you could lift the steering wheel off and hang it out, because that was the reason the steering wheel, there wasn't room for there. But when you're traveling, you drop it in, pick it up and hang it out the back and go, and then you could drive it. I fixed the problem. I was smart. Well, you know, I didn't do anything about it. And that's the same with the jack system. The old system they had with that high and low air and a valve in there, and they put the valve with the spring in, just it in a hole where it would corrode up and get rusty and then hang up a little bit. And that's the trouble. Then if you give more air, it would do it. But if you give more air to that one, then it would give air all to the good ones, and then they wouldn't work. And it was the same way there. I was lucky they gave me by then there was different. I had more options out there, and I went and got individual valves so that it worked each one, and just designed it, drew up a program for it, and changed the whole thing. I didn't try and fix the old one that they had tried to fix so long, and I found that, that's one thing I found out with all my troubles is, you have to be awful careful and not try to fix something that's not broken. That's what works good, and that way, and that's as good as it's going to work. You can't just because you know, think you know more than somebody else. You're not going to get away with that. So do something else about it. And the same, I was in paving. That's what I did too. When there was. Went to back to Vancouver Equipment. They had Barbara Green. They were paving, they had plants for paving contracts, companies, and they sold Barbara Green the pavers. And they were having trouble. But at that time, electronic screens were just coming out, so first controlling them. And they had quite a bit of problems with those. And so I worked with it. And the first thing that I did is that I got to know the people. And they had Italian, I guess they're Italians, and the offshore people, and running this manually, they was running it. And boy, I got to know them and talk to them because they didn't like that electric anyways, and they were kind of against it. And we were having trouble with the way it was laying and different things. And quite often, I'd go and talk to them, and they would say, it's not electric. The pavement is not mixed right, and the grade is not perfect. The grade is not perfect there, and it's impossible to fix. So, one time on the whole Princeton Highway there, they were having so much trouble with it that they were going to close them down. And Red here, and he called me, I don't know where I was, and said, you get over there right away and find out what's wrong with him. And so I went over, and luck with this fella, I'd known him real well. So I said, well, how come they're having so much trouble here with this? He said, oh, it's the big, because the guy's right in the factory up there. And he said, okay, they're working there. But he said, there's nothing wrong with that. He said, it's just the grade and the mix is wrong. And I said, well, how come you didn't tell me? He said, yeah, I wouldn't tell him anything. He said, they're so-and-so guys. And so I went to the told him, I said, there's nothing wrong with the machine. I checked it, so I could tell them. I said, our machine is working perfect. You always go and get your act together. And so they checked, and sure enough. And so, you know, I was a big hero. I didn't have anything, I just, same way. And again, they asphalt plant up and out of Campbell River, up past Quesnel, up there, and paving in that road. It was the same way there, that asphalt plant. And they'd sent me down to Barbara Green on the asphalt plant, but I didn't know anything about them otherwise the bookwork. And I had, that's one thing when I got in electric, is I was a master at looking, night and day, I'd read those great blueprints, so I was good at that. But I never worked one. Then Red sent me up there because they were going to close that down, the plant, and they had just moved in, and they just had no end of trouble with different things. So they sent me up, and boy, that was the one that worried me a little, because that was the first time I'd been out in one. But the people that were on it before I was new and was in it, I got to know them real well and babied up to them and knew the operators. And so when I went up there, the fellow, I knew him that was managing it, and he said, what are you doing up here? And I said, well, I'm coming up to fix your machine. So I said, the operator and that's running the screed and the two, and because I knew them. And so they went out, and right away they had a motor. There's four motors on a screed, and one of the things they burned out a motor, and they got a new motor, and they burned it out. And there was a couple other ones. So I went out and with the guys, and we took the motor, I guess, and I got them to change it. And then I talked to the other fellow, he's the operator, and asked him, and he told me exactly what was happening. And again, through knowing the schematics well enough, that if you do that, that's the big thing on it. It's just, if you know that, then it's just one circuit. It's not the whole works, like that big plant there. You know, you start running around that, drive you crazy. So, but if you know exactly that it's one wire, you know, you can put a gauge on it here and a gauge there, and you can tell that whole thing. You don't have to worry where it's going or coming from or anything. And so, you know, he told me exactly. And they fixed the motor up there, and so I said, well, start it up and run it and see what happens. And so it started up, of course, it ran good. And that's what they were saying, but before it ran good, but not for very long. I said, what you should do right now is come, let's have a look here. And ground now has these four motors. They should be exactly the same electricity, and they're going to all do the same. They should be all the same heat. And let's go around and check this. So the ground, and one way over in the corner over there, it was ice cold. What's this tell you? This motor is not doing any work. The other three are doing so. And right away then, the vibrator, and there was a thing there. So I said, let's have a look where it's clamped there. And I said, look, and there was a wire that sheared off there. So, you know, pull it out and put a new thing on. And I think the one downstairs is what they told me. And it was little simple things. And so I went back and told him, I guess it was late at night, to get the crew, go to work in the morning, as it is fixed. And he couldn't believe it. And yet, you know, it wasn't that smart. It was because they told me, well, what to do with it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big thing, is it's amazing how much information you can get from people that if you pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't Good. Think you know it all, because you don't.
Yeah, okay. Can I ask, so were you with Vancouver Equipment then until the end of your career?
No, what did I do? No, I actually, Vancouver Equipment sold out to another fellow, Peter, that's right.
Sampson.
Peter Hampson?
Sampson.
Peter Sampson, that's right. Peter's there you are. Yes, Peter Sampson. And Peter bought, what's the Vancouver Equipment now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did he buy Vancouver Equipment? Why is no? That's right. No, that's what it was. He bought Washington Ironworks. Decided they didn't want to be direct anymore, so they sold the branch to Peter. That's right. And Peter was over there begging me to come to work for him. And I did. And at that time, Vancouver Equipment was sold. That's the reason I went away. Because when I was there, that, like I say, Red Briscoe, he was manager of it, and the two people that owned it, two of them died, and the other one, what was his name? he was there, and I knew them right there, you know, from mm-hmm. years and years and years. And they knew what I could do, and what, so it was like my own company with them. So. When, but they had sold out, and they again with Peter, he was good with me. What he wanted me to do was be a salesman, but I told him that no way I'd be a salesman. That's the last thing I'd do. But I said, if you want, I said, I could go out, and in all likelihood, I know most of the loggers out on the coast. I said, I could probably find you people that wanted a piece of equipment. And I said, if you promise me that I can make the decisions, I'm not going to sell anybody a piece of equipment that they don't want. But I said, I can go out and talk to them. I know them, and quite often, I said, I can honestly tell them, hey, if you had our machine here, you can do so and so. And he said, well, that's fine, it's me, I'll do that. And I did, and I was extremely lucky. I guess it just at the right time they were changing, and I did SEVA and the West Coast, they were just starting up, and the people that contracted that, I knew them. And boy, the first year, I forget how many of that first convention that we had with him, I think it was five or six new machines that it sold. And that year it was just a raft. And it was good because I could go out and they knew me from most of the people there, and they knew that, or they thought that, mind you, I didn't know half as much as they thought I did, but still they knew that you know, I was going to be honest with them. And
that would have been in the 80s, would it? Was that the 80s?
It must have been, because I was, I think, about 10 years last year with him. Well, no, yeah, probably in the 90s, because when I forget when I retired now. But it really worked out good. And it was a good job, and I traveled all over, and even up at were we on strike? Why did we at that time, or maybe just no money? Because I went up to Alaska and traveled up there and met people up there, and I got work. And what was that? It was a good time there, I guess, when they had to lay everybody off.
Well, there was a strike. I don't remember.
But yeah, that I worked for Peter.
There may have been a really big strike in the mid-ish 1980s, maybe 1986.
Yeah,
if I remember. Yeah.
No, 86 was Expo.
Yeah, I think they maybe were on strike.
I can just.
Well, David, we're about 2 hours. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, is there anything else that you'd like to share that's very important that you'd like to have sort of captured and placed into the archives, or are you happy with?
Well, that's it. I don't know. But like I say, my bouncing around things, it's really nothing that I did. That,
oh, they're interesting.
There was, you know, nothing that was pretty much daily things that happened, so that certainly nothing that was done.
Sure.
That I, you know, there's any worry about.
Okay.
People knowing or not knowing, or I don't.
Well, that's okay. I mean, you've shared a great deal with us, so thank you for that, right? And thank you on behalf of researchers in the future who can access this conversation.
Well, maybe that might them to maybe, I don't know what they'd get out of it, because, you know, I think I was probably a lot of good luck there followed me, maybe, there. It seemed like I could quite easily, although I think it was important somehow that I got the groundwork there, and also through the truck logger and stuff, is that I think people kind of thought that, you know, I maybe knew a little more than, and I got the name. That's the same pretty well anything, I think, is if you can get recognized there and know that and get along too with people, you know, like with me, you know, with Medill and stuff in opposition. No equipment. If I was going out looking at something, you know, if I figured our machine wouldn't do it, and their other ones would, you know, I tell them, hey, you don't want to buy our machine, you want to buy Medill's. And, you know, I got along good with them. And they had their own plane. Why, if I was out some that weekend, they'd fly me home in their plane, and I'd work right with them. So I think that's a big thing, is to get known and get that name out there. If you got that name, quite often with equipment, Peter, when he took over there, it surprised him so much with quite a bit of equipment that I would. And again, I told him I don't want to be a salesman, but I can get people to buy them, and that's. Well, the first machine that when I got there, actually I knew ahead of time from Washington had the company, and that friend of mine, of course, I'd known him for years, Lawrence Below, and he had told me, we'd sold him a 78 yarder, and he had it about 2 years, and he just before that, he phoned in and asked them to send me up and have a look at his machine. I went up and I said, I want to bring the machine in and completely overhaul it. And I said, so because he was lugger and he kept his equipment in good shape. And so he said, you figure out how much it'll cost for me. So in the meantime, then I talked to Peter and he was going ahead in the deal. And they had a brand new, in this new model, 78 was called 78A instead of 78. And they wanted to get rid of it. And they were going to give a fair discount on it. So I talked to Peter and get all the dope. So then I went back to Lawrence and said, Lawrence, you know, this is how much that I think you should put into your machine. But also, I said, Washington got a brand new machine out, and they want to get rid of it, and there's a good price on it. And I said, you know, it might be worth your while to have a look at it, because I think it's quite a lot better machine. So I said, that's good enough for me, I'll do that. So I went back to Peter and told Peter, and that's right too, because there was another fellow that worked for him, and he'd quit, and he went over to Lillooet, and he wanted to go logging, and so I had told him about Lawrence's machine, and so I said to, and that's what Lawrence, we had to take his machine back and trade. So Peter said, well, that other machine. So I said, well, no, I know another fellow that will buy Lawrence's machine, and the stuff that's there, we can work that in and do that amount of work that has to be done on it. And I said, I know he'll buy the machine. And so Peter said, well, how do you know all this? And nobody's put anything down. And the same way with Lawrence, nobody is. I said, don't worry, their word is good. They'll do what they say. And and you know, he couldn't believe it, but bang, you know, they did. And that, again, because both of those people, so they get the name out there, and they know they can trust you. And I did that. I sold lots of equipment. People would phone me up and say, go and find me so-and-so machine and send it up and not even look. Peter couldn't get over that you know, they people, but that's what you have to do is get that name. If you get the name and you know that they trust you.
Right. Well, thanks for telling us all about it. Yeah, thanks for your time. Thanks for sharing.
You're certainly welcome.
Perfect. Yeah. Great. Thanks.